I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. Wow. We're going to have a Labor Day or almost Labor Day special. We'll cheat a little, just like we cheated when Jeff Nightbird interviewed me for my birthday. It really wasn't my birthday, but this is Labor Day weekend. We know that because we know the incredible traffic that's out there.
It's yes, indeed.
Crazy. I almost didn't make it, and I won't say it. And Hightower was, you know, on the line, too. So it's, but we're here, and we want to remind folks. Well, let me give you the business first. Rag Radio is comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on Co-op Radio, which is a cooperatively run, all-volunteer community radio station in Austin, Texas. We're also rebroadcast at at WFTE in Mount Cobb in Scranton, Pennsylvania, at KPFT in Houston on their HD3 channel, at KKRN 88.5 FM in Round Mountain, California, and we're a featured podcast at the Veterans Today website. And all of our shows are put up as podcasts at the Internet Archive. So that's most of the skinny. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. And
happy to be here. Thank you.
As always. And Roger Baker's here. My old friend Danny Schacht is here. And our guest, of course, is Jim Hightower, the inimitable Jim Hightower. Okay. Progressive populist writer and radio commentator and Rag Radio regular, Jim Hightower is my guest. We'll discuss, these are some of the things we might discuss, I'll have to say. The rebellious spirit of Matthew McGuire's first Labor Day. How to lift up the middle class and address income inequality, maybe we'll talk about. How Scott Walker is cutting higher education to fund corporate welfare. Just how bad the Trans-Pacific Partnership is for workers. And how certain bigwigs are scared that income inequality will bring about social unrest or, even worse, oppressive taxes on the super rich. Woo-hoo-hoo. Mm-hmm. Boy. Jim Hightower was twice elected Texas Agriculture Commissioner, has for years been a major force on the populist left. He broadcasts daily radio commentaries, publishes the Hightower Lowdown, and is the author of Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, and Thieves in High Places. And you can, all right. we want to talk about Labor Day history for one thing. That's where we want to start. But before we even do that, you are often known as, and in fact, I think you, even you, the America's number one populist. Hmm. Okay,
just some people question who's number two.
That's what I want to talk about. How about this new guy at the top?
Yeah,
Donald Trump,
a billionaire
America's populist. What about that?
Well, that is
how strange is that?
It is so much fun, except it's becoming sad and becoming dangerous. Not because of him; he's not going to get the nomination. He's not going to certainly win the presidency. But he is empowered an ilk that is willing to demonize very vulnerable people, immigrants, low-income folks, minorities, you know, et cetera, by his language. And that has, I noticed the other day when he had that press conference, I believe it was out in Arizona, and the Univision reporter was there, Ramos is his name, and he was questioning Trump, like journalists are supposed to do. And so Trump had him thrown out, you know. Right. And as he was carried out, some guy in the audience said, "Get out of my country." You know, well, this guy's born in the U.S., so it's his country, too. Yeah. But it unleashes, we go through this periodically in our history. Father Coughlin back in the Depression years, Joe McCarthy, George Wallace, you know. But, you know, we overcome this because it is not America. It's not who we are as a people. And we are built by just ordinary people. So immigration has been a key. After all, we're all immigrants, right? I mean, I don't recall any of the pilgrims having documents when they came
and
in.
And killed off most of the real indigenous people.
Came to this uninhabited land, it was claimed at the time. Of course, millions of Native Americans were here. a Native American champion whose name is escaping me at the moment, was asked some years ago, what did you people call this country before the white men came? And he said, ours. And it was theirs. But we marched in and, you know, took it over in a brutal, rather brutal sort of way. So the point is not to, you know, knock down America, but to build up America through good people who have come to this country and enriched us. And that is the danger of Trump, is that he adds to that. And not only does he empower just regular folks to express their biases and ugliness, but also other candidates. You got Scott Walker, you know, running around here in Texas this very week, talking about, well, yeah, we need that wall, got to build that wall. You know, yeah, I don't, no anchor babies, you know, I mean, this kind of stuff, you know. So he's babbling on. He's supposed to be one of the serious candidates, but he's been perverted by Trump, and you know, even George Bush, not Jeb Bush, you know, is out there talking about anchor babies and China and, you know, all these. It just distorts the dialogue into nuttiness. And meanwhile, we have a country that has actual needs, and a majority of people who have actual needs, and those are not even being talked about.
You know, one of the things that you talk about a lot and that we will also address later is the fact that there is a kind of significant grassroots movement happening in this country, and it has lots of different faces, and it's a very energetic movement, and it taps maybe what we would call a populist base in the country. But to close out the Trump question here, because everybody pays way too much attention to Trump, and we're guilty too. But it's a scary phenomenon. Is he tapping also something of what might be called a populist sentiment, a right-wing populist sentiment? And there's a grand tradition in this country of right-wing populists in the past.
And yes, he does tap into some legitimate populist concerns. You know, certainly inequality, income disparities, the lack of good jobs, good wages, the fact that hedge fund hucksters are able to pay, you know, less than half of the tax rate that, say, a school teacher pays, on and on. So, yeah, I mean, those are very legitimate topics for discussion. You know, he perverts them mainly by, you know, being a boisterous, boorish bully. And, you know, that's all right, because that's not going to work. I do think we spend too much time worrying about Trump, because he's getting, what, 25% apparently of the vote. That's the way it's put by the media. But that's 25% of the Republican primary voters, which are about – it comes down to less than 10% of the American people that share anything with him. So that is not the American spirit. And, you know, maybe it is good to surface it all, and let's just talk about it, put it out there on the table, and so we can actually have a discussion about some of that, you know, particularly the racist kind of stuff that he's putting forward.
I was listening to a report on, I believe it was on NPR, about all the neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups that have endorsed him, and they were quoting one person saying, "Oh, we haven't had a candidate for so long, and now we've got one." And I'm not sure that he's asking for that exactly, but he's
congratulations
in a larger sense,
them.
He's asking for it.
Yes, there he goes. Yeah, he got it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, let's. But he's not going to be the next president. But he's certainly having an effect. Labor Day.
Yeah.
This, of course, we're cheating, as I said. It's not, but it's Labor Day weekend.
There you go.
And tell us a little bit about how the history of Labor Day is.
You know, I got to looking into this because it just occurred to me, you know, here comes Labor Day. And I thought, well, where did this come from? Who gave this day off to working families? And I looked into some history textbooks, and they mostly, if they mention it at all, well, which most of them don't, they say, well, it came from Grover Cleveland, president of the United States in 1894, because he proclaimed a federal holiday for labor. And, you know, I knew a little bit about Grover Cleveland. Grover Cleveland was a What would amount to a, well, they called them Bourbon Democrats back then. He was a Democrat, but they were
kind of sour mash.
Sour mash and very corporate and supportive of the establishment and very anti any kind of rebellion that might go on. And so there was the Pullman strike. This was in Chicago, a company town called Pullman, now the south side of Chicago. And that strike was being led by workers for George Pullman, making the Pullman sleeping cars, they were called the palace cars, luxury travel on rail. And they were thoroughly exploited by George Pullman, who paid them a pittance and then housed them in this new town that he was very proud of, because it had no saloons were allowed, no newspapers were allowed.
Heaven forbid.
No discussion, open discussions, no town meetings, et cetera. This was a corporate town. You do it as we say you do it. Yeah. Well, then in 1894 came, and this was in the wintertime, harsh, harsh time, Pullman suddenly slashed their wages by a third, but he would not lower their rents. And so some people were trying to live on pennies and could not put food on the table. So they revolted. They had a strike. And that led to Eugene Debs, a great iconic labor leader, coming in and helping to organize. Became a national strike. The first national strike in America was this one. And so, of course, the robber barons, Pullman and other train barons, went running to the White House and got Grover Cleveland to sic the U.S. Army on these strikers. For the first time, the U.S. Army, some 12,000 troops, came out there to bust this strike in Chicago, and there were outbreaks elsewhere, and so they were busting people all over. Some 30 workers died, but six dozen of them were severely injured. Any worker who participated in the strike was fired and blacklisted. And so this was this was who George Pullman was and who Grover Cleveland was. And so Grover Cleveland didn't give this holiday to workers. So I looked into it, and it turns out that no, Labor Day came from 1882.
Okay, and we're going to have to tell that story in a minute.
Let's do it.
But it does sound to me like Grover Cleveland was an appropriate person to to name Labor Day.
Exactly,
inspire Labor Day. Okay, we're talking with Jim Hightower on Rag Radio.
The song's known all around the world now.
Was a union maid. She never was afraid of the goons and the geeks and the company finks and the deputy sheriff that made the raid to the union hall when a meeting it was called. When the legion boys come around, she always stood her ground.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union.
Scare us, we're sticking to the union. Okay.
That's right.
Pete Seeger, what a great, great champion of labor, but also, you know, anti-war, the environment, et cetera. And he was a low-down subscriber to my Hightower Lowdown. I've known Pete for, I don't know, 40 years, I guess, something like that. But what a champion, what a model.
Yeah, what a loss, too. He was a remarkable
man. But he inspired so many people to come.
So they
with him.
That's his afterlife.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Wait, Union Maine.
Well, it had a clip that's like referring to another Pete Seeger song. It's like Union Maine in that lyric. Oh, okay. But that was sticking with the Union. Oh, that was okay. Pete Seeger with a gentleman by the name of A.C. Cargill. And that happened to come off an album called Pullman, referring to the Pullman strike. Oh, right. That we were talking about. Right. So it's timely.
Okay, Jim Hightower is my guest. Populist, I always say populist pundit, but I don't know. That's because I'm an alliterative sort
of guy.
Good
enough. Yeah. They call worse.
So let's get back to the history of that you were giving us.
Yeah, because it's not...
The history of Labor Day.
History makes it sound kind of barren and boring, but actually...
The living history of Labor Day.
The people's history, as Howard Zinn did in his great book, is very lively. And it's about stories. And so in 1862, there was this amalgamated union in New York City. The New York Central Labor Union, that was a function of the 59 unions in the area there, including New Jersey. A guy named Matthew McGuire, he was a machinist, and he was Secretary Treasurer of this body. And so he proposed one day, well, we need to have a big parade. Now, it was not a parade to just show off. It was a protest. We wanted to protest because wages were $2 a day, 12-hour days, 6 days a week. That was the situation of labor at the time. And so they were trying to organize, and it was the beginning of the labor movement. And so he said, I propose that we have this this parade. And everybody said, hip, hip, hooray, let's have a parade.
Everybody loves a parade.
Yeah. And again, it was to be a protest, to make a statement about the situation, and to call for wage and hour laws. We need a higher wage and shorter hours. And so the call was made, and the date was set, and it was in September. And they were worried because all the unions had pledged, oh, yes, we'll be there. But nobody had actually committed anything, so many of our movements do. It's a lot of talk. And so that day came. And there was McGuire and other organizers, and they were standing around, down around City Hall in New York City, and 80 people were there, 80 people, 80. Not a big parade.
Right.
And so they were worried, but then came a sound from a little bit distant, and it was drums and fife, and suddenly around the corner came the Jewelers Union from Newark, New Jersey, 200 strong, with a 35-member marching band. And so they came in and said, all right, we'll kick off the parade now. And they kicked it off, and a couple of blocks down the road, here came 400 400 iron workers coming in from a side street. And about every street that they'd come across, more unions would join. And they came with bands, they came with floats. The bricklayers had three or four floats, wagons, horse-drawn wagons, and would have arches of brick to show off their skills.
And if a riot happens, they've already got the brick.
They've got the brick, exactly. It was said that they carried some in their pocket. Each member had a brick chunk in their pocket. And so 12,000 people were in this march before it was. And right up Park Avenue, right past Astor's mansion on Park Avenue, right past the clubs, the hideaways of the rich, and et cetera, and just a amazing show of strength of labor. And then they ended up at a picnic at a park, Elm Park, that had the largest beer hall in the city. And stuff for kids, plenty of room for picnics and some games and all this stuff. So it was a perfect model for us today, because too often we try to have a movement that's based on meetings, rather than what if we had some fun and
we have some committees.
What if we had a function that people actually wanted to come to and bring their kids and bring their spouses and friends and everything, and let's get together and put the party back in politics. Well, that's what that was, and that was the first Labor Day, and the name came from that. And then that quickly spread. By the time Grover Cleveland got around to approving the Labor Day, I think it was some 30-something states had already sanctioned Labor Day because labor spread this thing. And it was, again, not just about getting a day off so we can go to the beach or go to a ball game or play a round of golf or sleep in or whatever, but a day to stand up and talk about what the issues of the time are for working people.
To what extent do you think people at this point in time in this country actually, and of course it's international, what do you think, how many people do you think actually realize the content as opposed to going to the beach or whatever?
Oh, a fraction. I mean,
or acknowledge it, or,
I mean,
or do
the great there. Irony is Labor Day is essentially about, as you picked up the American Statesman today, it was filled with ads to go to the mall and buy some stuff. Well, that the great irony of that, of course, is that means that millions of retail clerks across this country, low-wage paid people in these chain stores, are having to put in a full shift or more on the day that they're supposed to have off.
Yeah.
The opposite of Labor Day.
Okay, Labor Day. Coming right up. And everybody's on the road right now going out to the beaches and the whatever, or to the malls to shop. Okay, here's something I want to ask you. Jim Hightower is my guest. Phil Gramm campaigning against bigotry and exploitation of workers. We've always known that Phil Gramm has a great reputation as being a people's man.
Yes.
So what is, tell us about this.
Well, when Phil Gramm was trying to run for president back in the 90s, when he was a U.S. senator, I saw a guy on TV saying, because Phil kept putting his foot in his mouth, and he'd said something outrageous on a particular day, and this guy, one of his fellow Republicans in the Congress, said, "Well, sometimes Phil is his own worst enemy." And I said, "Not while I'm alive, he's not." So Phil Gramm essentially created the Wall Street crash of 2009 by deregulating, with the support of Bill Clinton, I have to say it right up front, the Wall Street barons to be able to get into all these casino exercises that they're involved in that then crash the economy. Then, having done that, got that bill passed, the Gramm-Bliley Act, it was called, then he went to work for a Wall Street bank. Big surprise, you know. So he's been a millionaire now on Wall Street. But he came down to Washington earlier this year to testify about the plight of a put-upon set of the American people. And it was the millionaires and billionaires and the Wall Streeters. He was just outraged that they were being criticized by commoners and riffraff, like you, Thorne.
Not me.
Yes, he knows. He knows your name. He knows where
I'm
you
sure
are.
He does.
And so,
in fact, here he is right now.
So Phil was just outraged, and he's not alone. In this last week, suddenly in the New York Times was a full page ad defending Carly Fiorina, who's one of the 17 Republicans running for president, and she ran Hewlett-Packard and ran it into the ground. And so she fired 30,000 workers, nice Labor Day tribute to her, and she plummeted the stock price of that corporation. So she got fired. So that's her qualification now to run for president.
Right.
She subsequently ran for U.S. Senate out in California and got drubbed there. Yeah. So she has two losses that makes her eligible to be president of the United States. Okay. Here's this full-page ad, because the New York Times had run a story saying that she had not quite a sterling business record, as she was saying she did. And so this guy named Tom Perkins took out a full-page ad in the New York Times. I don't know what that cost, $20,000 or something. That's nothing to him, because he's a hedge fund huckster, a billionaire, saying that he attested to the skills and the quality and the smartness of Carly Fiorina. This is the same guy who had also expressed just furious anger at the fact that billionaires like him and Wall Streeters, the successful people in our society, was the way he put it, were being demonized by the 99%, by the Occupy Wall Street people, and et cetera, and some politicians, and he wanted this to stop. And so he, of course, then he stepped way deeper than he meant to by saying that the attacks on the rich today are comparable to what the 1% of Germans went through under the Nazis, which was their Jewish people. So he was comparing criticism of billionaires to the Holocaust. So he was fairly roundly derided and ridiculed for that. Then he came right back and he said that he had a solution for the demonization of the rich, and that it was that voting in this country for public office should be like corporations do it. The more stock you have, the more votes you get. So if you have, if you pay $1 million in taxes, you get 1 million votes. So this is this man's solution. So why are we listening to these goofballs? You know, Donnie Trump is not the only one. You know, there's a world of these billionaires.
There's some questions about Donnie Trump's business acumen, too.
Yeah, well, I think he had 4 bankruptcies, yeah, I believe, yeah. But who's counting? You know?
Yeah, well, but that puts him on top, too. I mean, so there's all kinds of ways.
And a lot of public subsidies, by the way.
Public subsidies, yeah.
To kind of diffuse some of that defense, it's like from folks like this, is there something to be learned? Should we not criticize them as billionaires, but criticize them as folks who take advantage of being billionaires and kind of direct our message that way?
Yes, and who take public subsidies and et cetera to become billionaires.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, who is it, Voltaire or somebody said that behind every great fortune is a great crime. You know?
Well, and with Donald Trump, of course, he had, what, $4 million to start out with?
Daddy stepped in and helped him out there.
Daddy's
got him
money.
A good start. He was
$4 million then.
A New York City real estate baron himself. So.
Right. So,
and that's where he bought his hair, I understand.
No. It's just a comb over.
Yeah.
So that's unclear. What is it that that he's called on? A Mexican radio talk show host. I can't remember the term, but his term is something like, you know, the
right.
hairpiece,
yeah, right.
whatever.
Yeah, right.
The hairpiece in Spanish.
Yeah.
So, and he's a piece. He's a hairpiece of work. I would say.
Well, the good news out of all this is that labor is on the move again, and not driven by just the established unions wanting to take care of their existing members, but a grassroots rebellion led actually by the fast food workers and other low wage workers, but mainly fast food
and Walmart workers. Maybe.
Yeah, Walmart and fast food and others. And they are, you know, these are the least likely people to rebel. They're the least educated, very hard to organize because, you know, they're having to work 3 or 4 jobs, you know, to make ends meet and still try to deal with the family, and they travel on public transportation. They don't have limousines to get to the McDonald's and then get over to the Walmart for the other shift, you know. So the fact that they stepped out there and are the most vulnerable, easily fired by the McDonald's and Walmarts, who are accustomed to firing such people. And they have been the lead on this. And so we have this phenomena of, it's called Fight for $15 an hour, that would have been considered ludicrous just a year ago. You know, in fact, Obama was proposing a wage increase that the Republicans in Congress were saying, no way we're going to do that. And it was $9 an hour. But now we're at 15 because Seattle has passed it. San Francisco has passed it. Los Angeles has passed it. Other states are passing that level of a wage increase. Numbers of companies are coming forth. And by the way, that began with independent companies. P. Terry's here was one of the quasi-fast food sort of places that has that produces a quality product and was paying a fair wage and raised that wage before all this stuff even started. So there were all these independents coming forth and saying it's hogwash that you can't pay a fair wage. We have to pay a fair price for the meat and the burger and the buns and that sort of thing. So why can't we pay a fair wage? If you don't pay a fair wage, you don't have a legitimate business. You're stealing from people. And so this movement has now spread to where the minimum wage level is getting toward that $15 an hour and lifting up the economy of all the rest of us in the process.
Okay, we're talking with America's number one populist, sit down, Donald Trump, Jim Hightower, and we'll be back in just a minute. Thank you.
afraid of goons and ginks and company finks and the deputy sheriffs who made the raid. She went to the Union Hall when a meeting it was called, and when the Legion boys come around, she always stood her ground.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union. I'm sticking to the Union.
Okay. Very nice. A little bit of Pete Seeger. It's like in theme of what we're talking today with Mr. Jim Hightower for Labor Day.
Cool. Yes.
Yeah. I go back to the Texas Observer with Ray Reese. I was editor there about 150 years ago, and Ray was a young writer at the time.
Yeah. You know, it's great. We have guy. To tell you that Hightower comes in with his cane and his, he has,
yeah, right.
You know, yeah, right. his you know, glasses down on his nose, yeah, and he, right. You know, yeah. It's, you know, it was at least 150. Yeah, no, he's a youngster. Hightower's a youngster. Mm. Please get in touch.
You know, listening to that Pete Seeger song again, Sticking with the Union, you know, the basic assault by the corporate powers today on unions is a soft one. They're saying, well, yes, unions serve their purpose. 100 years ago, they were needed then because corporations were not very nice. Right. But now we live in this entrepreneurial economy, and workers are entrepreneurial themselves. They don't need to cooperate. They need to compete with each other. So we don't need unions. Well, that's not selling very well. And it's true that just before the crash of the economy, for the first time ever, less than 50% of the American people had a favorable feeling toward unions. And now it's 6 out of 10 do since that crash. And I think it's something like more than two-thirds that now say, if we could join a union, we would, because they've basically rigged the laws so that it makes unionizing of a workplace or an industry almost impossible. But unions are stepping out. And supporting people like the fast food workers who are not yet unionized, and taking stands that are going to make a difference for just ordinary people.
I think if we polled the governors, however,
yeah,
the support for unions would be much lower, and all of the assault on public sector workers.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of
Scott
thing.
Walker and I, you know, I was up there at that Wisconsin rally, Madison, Wisconsin, 4 years ago, I think it was, when, you know, 150,000 people or whatever it was. It was big, I know, because I was standing up there doing my speech.
It was bigger than a Bernie Sanders rally.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Bernie a little bit, because okay, cool. You know, it's not all bad news with Trump and et cetera. We've got a real populist running for president of the United States, and I know, you know, I'm not here to tell you how to vote, but to say that here's one guy that I've known for 30 years. In fact, did some campaigning for him in Vermont when he was first running for the House. And he's out there. He has stunned himself and everybody else, I think, by saying, you know, I'm just going to go out there and talk about this inequality and talk about the kind of country we ought to have and what the big shots and BSers and bastards and bosses and bankers are doing to us, and see what happens. Well, what happened is an explosion of support. 27,000 people in Portland, Oregon, 12,000 people in Phoenix, Arizona, 10,000 in Dallas, 8,000 in Dallas. And, you know, we had an event here that Danny Fantante, a great union guy here in town, put together out at the IBEW Hall on Highway 71, and back in February before
he'd even announced, and it was so packed to the seams that people were actually falling out windows.
Yeah, we had to put speakers up outside, you know, and all that. And I said to Bernie, I said, I think something's happening here. And he said, yeah, I think so too. So,
yeah, who was it that introduced him? I'm trying to remember.
Oh, I don't remember.
Jim Hightower.
Oh, that handsome guy.
That handsome devil.
I was so dazzled by his looks, I couldn't remember the name.
Well, I mean, and what do you think the Sanders phenomenon means towards the future populist movement.
It means at least another step forward. And we have a credible presidential candidate. We have others too. Elizabeth Warren, of course, in the U.S. Senate. Sherrod Brown in the Senate as well. Our own Lloyd Doggett was in the lead on this fight against this Trans-Pacific partnership scheme and scam that they're trying to hammer down, hang around our necks. And Lloyd did a terrific job there. I had other members of Congress saying to me that he was just a spark plug for leading the opposition that has now stalled that albatross.
I remember when I was at UT, to the extent that I was at UT, I was a dropout more often than I was a student, but that Lloyd Doggett, I think, was president of the student body then, or he was...
At one time he was, and that was,
I think, when I was there. And when I did this story for the Texas Observer about the spies of Texas and the stuff that the campus police had gathered, all the intelligence, all the spying they had done, and he was included.
Yeah.
There was, just like Kiki Friedman.
So these voices make a difference. They make a difference. Being in Congress, your main job is not to go vote.
Right.
Your main job is to, what do we had leaders who led? And Lloyd Doggett is one of those. Bernie Sanders is another. Yeah. And just the fact of him stepping out, he has totally changed the debate in the Democratic primary. I mean, Hillary Clinton is scrambling and has had to come over further than she wanted to talk about these people's issues in unequivocal terms, not just these wishy-washy words, but say, I'm on this side.
Right.
As I learned in politics, it's not enough to be for workers, to be for the environment. I mean, everybody will say that, but you got to be against the people who are keeping the workers and the environment and consumers and other interests from rising up. You've got to be willing to take on the powers that be.
When you mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I think that's a very interesting, an interesting phenomenon for two reasons. One, because how bad it is. I mean,
grotesque.
Arguably bad it is.
demonstrably
bad it is. I'm sorry. I won't take any step back there. And the other thing about it is, and this is a theme that you always want, that you always stress when we're talking about all the bad things that are happening. The response to it and the grassroots opposition to it has been also phenomenal. So it's a kind of interesting way of telling that story.
Oh, absolutely. Lyndon Johnson used to say you can't make chicken salad out of chicken manure. He didn't say manure, but nonetheless, you get the point.
I don't think he even knew the word.
And that's all they've got to work with. This thing is just grotesque. I mean, it really is. It undercuts workers. It undercuts our health care here and around the world. It empowers drug companies to be able to gouge us even worse than they now do. It messes with internet neutrality, and mainly it undermines in a very serious way our sovereignty as a people. It allows corporations in any of the 12 nations that are going to be a part of this thing, if it were to pass, to be able to go to a international tribunal that is secretive and is run by corporate lawyers. they work for these corporations, and they can sue a corporation in our country, for example, on the basis that or they can sue our government, I'm sorry, on the basis that, say, a minimum wage law or a Buy Austin law undermines their future profits. And they get to decide that not in our courts, but in this international corporate tribunal. So this thing is bad. And so their problem is that the more people get to see of it and smell of it, then they
which
are
means
against
the
it.
More it can be postponed before
exactly.
it actually.
So and that has already happened.
Yes.
This great group, Global Trade Watch, part of Public Citizen in Washington, has really been the leader in this. But a number of a huge coalition of groups have, again, environmental and consumer labor, et cetera, come together on this, farmers too, and have now shoved this thing off. Obama, well, originally they thought they could pass it in 2013. They moved it to 2014. Then to March of this year they were going to pass it. Then it was going to be in June. Then it was going to be in November of this year. And now it'll be deep into next year when we're in the weeds of the presidential contest. So they're in a heap of hurt despite this coalition of 500 of the largest corporations in our country backing it, Obama backing it, the full congressional Republican leadership.
What's going to happen to it?
I think we're going to win. And this has come from the grassroots. Lori Wallach and the Global Trade Watch, they're a staff of 11 people, and they were up against this humongous, impossible force. And they have already, again, pushed it back all those years and times. We have won fight after fight, and now we've shoved it in the next year. And I think because it's in a bad year for them, I think we're going to defeat it.
And on that note.
Yeah.
Jim Hightower. Thank you for being with us. We're out of time.
A joy always.
It's always a joy, and we always want to go another hour, but no. So, all right.
It's happy hour.
It's happy hour. Yes, it is, isn't it? Okay, we want to thank everybody for being with us. It's been a great show. Next week, award-winning world music band Attash, and the week after that, iconic musician and poet Ed Sanders of the Fugs will be with us. Woo! So, okay, this is Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer.